To most of us, suffering is a fact of life. It seems inevitable. The human dissatisfaction has been a major concern of all religious traditions. Buddhism has adopted a very practical approach in the face of the inability to remain happy. The historical Buddha has discouraged his followers from depending on anything external, spiritual authorities, dogmas, empty rituals. Nor would he expound on comforting metaphysical theories. He held that these were irrelevant. Instead, he presented his followers with a straightforward analysis of their existential predicament. He pointed out that all things were impermanent, that our lives are short and restricted and ultimately unsatisfying. This diagnosis in itself would have been quite a bleak teaching if the Buddha hadn't described a cure, the path to enlightenment. It's a restatement or new formulation of the perennial teachings of ancient India. According to these teachings, we suffer because we are subject to greed and hatred, and because we live in ignorance. We are ignorant of our true nature, of our real nature. Our real nature lies beyond our so often painful existence. Our real nature is untouched by suffering. The Buddha called it, among other names, the deathless. In the Upanishadic tradition of India, it's known as pure consciousness, absolute consciousness. It's the Tao of Taoism. It's the Godhead of mystical Christianity. And it's always experienced as an omnipresent vastness. That would be the common denominator. Everything else are just names, descriptions. The impulse to open up towards a higher manifestation of consciousness, towards something transcendent, is deeply implanted in the human being. It's an evolutionary urge. In most people, this impulse is experienced as a longing for peace, a peace that is undisturbed by the movements of the egoic personality. The spiritual yogi and the, let's take a bad example, drug addict are longing for the same kind of peace, for the same kind of deep rest in themselves. One of them is going about in a wise way, the other one in an ignorant way. But the hidden impulse is the same. This longing, this impulse towards something which is greater than we are, something transcendent, can reveal itself anywhere, anytime, even in the darkest environments. I have found it in the underworld, which we visit once a year. I step down into the underworld, literally. I visit a high security prison in one of the murder capitals of the world, Johannesburg, South Africa, to teach Qigong and silent meditation. To teach to inmates who have signed up for Buddhist teaching. The prison, it's called the Lion's Head Prison, is built against a slope. So if I go to the cell where I teach, I have literally to walk down through a number of somber cages until I get to that dingy room where the prisoners are waiting for me. Out of the 1,600 criminals in that high security prison, there are about 16, 17 who are interested on working on themselves. They're all driven by this longing I had mentioned. I can see it, I can feel it, and they tell me. They're extremely motivated to sit, to do the exercises, to practice along. The quest for wholeness and transcendence has enthralled mankind since ever. Ancient myths and tales tell of the same archetypal story of that search. Societies have handed down their stories of great heroes who have made the journey. In ancient Greece, we have Odysseus, who seeks his island home of Ithaca. Or Jason, who looks for the golden fleece. In Arthurian England, we have the Knights of the Round Table, who ride out on their most sacred mission, the quest for the Holy Grail. Though the details of the myths, of the tales, differ in terms of time, of culture, there is always the same inner pattern. First, the initial challenge. Let's take the Buddha. The Buddha Gautama Siddhartha, as he was known in those days, leaves his palace on four occasions. On his first outing, he meets someone sick. On the second, someone old. On the third, a corpse. Sickness, old age, and death. His existential situations shake him to the core. The initial challenge. On his fourth excursion into the city, he sees a yogi who seems to be free. And that image triggers in him that overwhelming longing for transcendence. The initial challenge, and then the call to a fuller life, the promise of a new state of being, the embarking on the journey, which is followed by a number of adventures, sometimes failures. And often, it's in the middle of a failure when the conversion to a new life happens. Conversion to a new life happens? Does that sound okay? Conversion to a new life happens. A story. A personal story. A Gaia House story. Many, many years ago, I did a personal retreat at Gaia House, during which I terribly failed. It was very difficult to sit for me. I was bored. I was restless. I had doubts. I was longing for human interaction. I realized that I was at the wrong place at the wrong time. I had heard of Findhorn. Group work being offered there. I stopped my retreat at Gaia House and went up to Findhorn. I arrived the night before that week-long workshop started. I had booked over the phone from Gaia House. I was assigned a flat which I had to share with two neurotic women from New York City. And I thought, this won't be awesome. The prospect to be with these two women for a whole week seemed even worse than to sit in cold Gaia House. Gaia House was very cold in those days because Gaia House couldn't afford to heat the building. I was inhabiting a dormitory in which I had constructed a tent out of blankets. I had gone into lovely Newton Abbott to get an electrical stove. I lived in the tent in the dormitory in old Gaia House. The next morning, early, when everybody was still asleep, I sneaked out of Findhorn and traveled back to Gaia House as quickly as I could to resume my meditation. If meditation had been difficult before, it became virtually impossible now. I was tortured by the realization that I was a complete failure. I gave up again. The pain being a failure was so great, it was so unbearable, that at some point the ego did let go of itself. There was a letting go of the ego happening, and the struggle stopped. and peace arose. I was still a failure. That was true. Yes, I'm a failure. But it didn't matter anymore. My interactions with the world, they became now based on, one could call it love. If someone hurted me, I was responding with empathy. I failed at Guy House. But then, of course, after some time, that state wore off and the old personality re-established itself. Then later I tried to produce, to fabricate self-defeat, self-humiliation, but it didn't work, of course. Yeah. The ego can't get rid of itself by will. Back to the myths and the tales. In these archetypal patterns, there always comes a point which is a kind of apotheosis for the heroes, for the heroines. Integrated with the cosmos, they embody their true nature and return to society as an example and as an inspiration. This pattern is beautifully exemplified in the famous 10 herding pictures in the Chinese Zen tradition. There are 10 pictures. There's a herdsman, first picture, a herdsman who is looking for an ox. Where is the ox? Then he finds the ox. He tames it. He rides on it. And then suddenly he disappears along with the ox and reappears by himself as an enlightened being. It's the allegory of man's search for his Buddha nature. The herdsman is the seeker. The ox is the ultimate reality, and the dealing with the ox, the discovering and integration of one's Buddha nature. In the 10th picture, in the last picture, the herdsman returns to society. And as it says in the quote, he returns to the marketplace with bliss bestowing hands. Again, the impulse to awaken is an evolutionary spark in consciousness. It comes from beyond the ego. It originates from our deepest nature, from the source. From the perspective of separation, it's the perspective which most of mankind hold. We are individual beings seeking this, seeking that. Always driven by seeking. We are part of this unfolding, ever-changing play called life, with its pain and pleasure. With its hope and despair, its birth and death, and its innate spin towards awakening, towards transformation. Jalaluddin Rumi has written a poem which has become quite famous on this particular idea of transformation. I died as a mineral and became a plant. I died as plant and rose to animal. I died as animal and I was man. Why should I fear? When was I less by dying? Yet, once more I shall die as man to soar with angels blessed. But even from angelhood I must pass on. All except God does perish. All except God does perish. From the perspective of oneness, from the enlightened perspective, we are the source. We are both. We are seeker, and at the same time, we are source. We are the source seeking itself. Let us sit for a moment and relax.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.